Charlie Chan movies have always been a guilty pleasure of mine. He was the not politically correct Chinese-American detective played by an actor who was not Chinese, doling out wisdom while fighting crime.
There is old saying, death is a black camel that kneels unbidden at every gate. Tonight, black camel has knelt here.
The first Chan film was in the 1920s. It was based on a novel by Earl Durr Biggers, inspired by a real-life Hawaiian detective. Yunta Huang, an English professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, has written a book about the real Charlie Chan. Yunta Huang's first encounter with the fictional character was in 1994.
When I was a student in Buffalo, one day I went to an estate sale and I found these two Charlie Chan novels. I had never been to an estate sale before because they don't really exist in China. And Linda, you may know that the Chinese almost never buy stuff from the dead. So I was literally terrified to buy these two books. But I did anyway, and I took them home, and I was immediately hooked. And after Buffalo, I went to teach at Harvard. And by that point, I already knew that E.D. Biggers, the creator of Charlie Chan, was a Harvard man. Through reading and researching on Biggers, I was really astonished to discover that there was a real Charlie Chan, and he had been neglected in history.
Well, now, the real Charlie Chan, who was he?
Well, his name is Chang Apana. He was a 5-foot-tall Cantonese cop in Honolulu in the early 20th century. He had been a paniolo, that's Hawaiian for cowboy, before he joined the police force in 1898, just when Hawaii was annexed by the United States. As a police officer, he walked almost the most dangerous beats in Chinatown, carrying a bullwhip. And he was a master of disguise. And one time, he single-handedly arrested 40 people without firing a shot.
You described that in the prologue to the book. I wonder if you could just read a little bit.
Sure. Climbing up the rickety stairs to the second floor, he turned and faced the room packed with gamblers, all Chinese, huddling over games of fantan, paikao, craps, and mahjong. The air was a mix of smut and smoke, the den ringing with curses, jeers, and the sound of clicking dice and mahjong tiles. He observed the ballyhoo through his dark lenses. Someone at the mahjong table looked up and immediately recognized the face of the infamous cop whose name elicited shudders from the spines of Honolulu criminals. Chai Lo! Before the Cantonese cry for cop dropped to the ground, a 5-foot bullwhip had uncoiled like a hissing rattlesnake from the detective's waist. One crisp snap of the whip and the entire room froze like a gambling hall diorama under glass. Only clouds of cigarette smoke still wavered, the afterthoughts of exploded firecrackers, not sure where to settle in the deafening silence. Many there had already heard of, and some had even tasted, the might of this unusual weapon wielded by the former rough-riding Paniolo. Resisting arrest would be futile, even though they knew he had, as usual, brought no backup. His whip had spoken louder than any law or gun.
Now, Earl Durr Biggers obviously took liberties with the Honolulu detective and changed him from a Hawaiian cowboy into a more stereotypical character.
That's true. I mean, even physically, you know, like I said, Chang Apana was 5 foot tall and he's really skinny and wiry. The Charlie Chang in the movies and novels and, you know, what he looks like.
Sort of a portly fellow with a beard and...
with dainty steps. And
rather formally dressed.
Right. Exactly.
The Charlie Chan novels came out at a time when the United States was involved in one of its fairly frequent outbursts of nativism. There was a lot of hostility to immigrants of all kinds, but particularly Chinese and the West Coast. But the Charlie Chan novels were very popular, and then the movies which followed them were also very popular.
Yes.
How do those two things go together, America for Americans and loving Charlie Chan?
Yeah, Charlie Chan, like I said, is really it's a kind of real mystery in many ways. So at his origin, really, when he first appeared, you know, in 1925, that was right after the infamous Johnson-Reed Act was passed in the United States. That was really the first kind of legislative, shall we say, racism against foreigners.
The Johnson-Reed Act limited immigration.
Yes, mostly from Southern Europe and Eastern Europe, really. And the other group was Japanese. So Charlie Chang appearing at that critical moment when the country had just closed its door, you know, to so-called foreigners with all his exoticism, aphorisms, etc., etc. This is really a strange kind of love-hate relationship. And it really manifests itself later on in Asian American reactions to Charlie Chang. On the one side, you have a lot of people who really love this kind of beloved character. On the other hand, he's also hated by Asian Americans.
Do you think that it had something to do with the fact that the character who played Charlie Chan was not Chinese? That was the one most often think of as Warner Oland, who is Swedish.
Exactly, yes. In the book, I call this kind of, you know, yellow face, so-called, to go along with, you know, the American traditions of blackface, redface, etc., etc. He's the embodiment, let's say, of this kind of racist legacy on the one hand, and really the creative genius of this great country on the other hand.
Charlie Chan movies were big hits in Asia, especially in China, where apparently the idea of yellowface, a European playing Charlie Chan, was not a problem.
You know, I grew up in China, and I used to watch a lot of Chinese operas. And it is a very common thing in Chinese opera to do this kind of ventriloquism or to have cross-dressing, for instance. So performing the other, that's kind of imitation, is always part of this kind of artistic culture of China. And so in the 30s, when you know, Charlie Chan movies were being shown in Shanghai or Beijing or major cities in China, people flocked to the theaters and, you know, they loved him, especially with his kind of pseudo fortune cookie aphorisms. It was quite an attraction to Chinese at the time.
Professor Huang, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yunta Huang is a professor of English at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His new book is called Charlie Chan. What do you think about that fortune cookie wisdom from Charlie Chan?
They're great. How can you not like them?
Actions speak louder than French.
Tongue often hang man quicker than rope.
Smart fly keep out of gravy.
Man who flirt with dynamite sometimes fly with angels.
So as we've heard, there are apps for weight loss. But way back in prehistoric analog times, back in the 20th century, companies promised the secret to slimming down with the technology of their time. And still today, you'll find it at every cafe and grocery store, the artificial sweetener. And if that's not something you think of as technology, well, according to Carolyn de la Peña, the sweetener is one of the 20th century's most significant technological advancements. Professor de la Peña teaches at the American Studies Department at the University of California, Davis. She's the author of a new book called Empty Pleasures, The Story of Artificial Sweeteners from Saccharin to Splenda. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And when do we mark the dawn of artificial sweeteners?
Well, artificial sweeteners began with saccharin, which was invented in the 1870s. But the dawn for consumers came in the early 20th century when people found out that, quite unbeknownst to them, saccharin had been replacing sugar in a lot of carbonated beverages and canned foods. And it was actually part of that progressive era where consumers sort of revolted against impurities in their food. So it didn't start out well.
But the pitch behind the artificial sweetener was, use it and you'll be slimmer. You'll look better.
Right, and so that actually occurred after saccharin appeared on the market the first time. So after World War II, when people had to try to find other forms of sweetener when sugar was rationed, consumers began to experiment with things like honey, and saccharin was one of the things that people also used.
Well, by the 1960s. People could see a commercial like this one on television. This was for Coca-Cola's sugar-free, that is to say, saccharin-flavored Coke substitute, pre-diet Coke era. It was called Tab.
Don't you want to have a good shape? He wants you with a good shape. Shape with Tab.
Tab can help you stay in his mind. It's sugar-free, and it tastes better than any diet cola.
For those who never understood why there was a counterculture in 1968, there's a commercial from those days aimed at women. You'll stick in his mind if you have a good shape with Tab.
I love that ad. Yeah, and I think you have to put that in this context when suddenly foods had appeared so much cheaper, and new advertising messages, that especially for women, really surrounded them with this message that, you know, food is happiness and you should indulge yourself. And at the same time, there's the competing message that women have to be thin. So products like Tab really cleverly position themselves as able to do these two things.
You write about artificial sweeteners as a feature of technology. Let me, I looked this up on the web. Here's a lab experiment, as far as I'm concerned. In a saucepan over medium heat, reduce Merlot to half volume, add tomato paste, mustard, and seasonings. Whisk until smooth, add cream, and simmer the sauce until reduced by half and thickened. Is that technology, or is that just cooking?
That's a great question. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, cooking is technology. Cooking is chemistry. Our food products are technologies. I think what's so different about artificial sweetener is that it's a technology not only created in the lab, as are so many things that we eat these days, but that also really fundamentally transforms our experience of sweet. Artificial sweeteners that we use today are between 200 and 600 times per part sweeter than table sugar. And so in that sense, it's a technology that not just sort of does what we think it does, which is removes calories from what we're ingesting, but I think also has an impact on how we experience sweetness and then how we continue to desire it more.
Yeah, we become addicted to sweetness. Maybe not sugar, but that pleasant sensation.
Absolutely. There are studies that are coming out now that do show a correlation between artificial sweetener consumption and weight gain, quite the opposite of what we think we're getting when we opt for those diet sweets.
Well, Professor De La Peña, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
That's Carolyn De La Peña, who's the author of Empty Pleasures, the Story of Artificial Sweeteners from Saccharin to Splenda. This is NPR. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel, with the story of one kid from Queens who saw his life reflected through a book of science fiction. It comes from the writer Gary Steingart for our series, My Guilty Pleasure.
I grew up as a science fiction nerd, probably the biggest one in the borough of Queens. Yearly subscription to Isaac Asimov's science fiction magazine? Check. Crayon-drawn diagrams of the Battlestar Galactica? You got it. Soylent Green, Planet of the Apes, Logan's Run, I knew them by heart. But I reserved my biggest nerd passion for a John Boorman novel called Zardoz. I'm holding the gaudy saffron-colored paperback in my hands right now. God help me, I still read it to this day. What's Zardoz about? I have no idea. By any measure of logic, it makes absolutely no sense. But like every other piece of 1970s science fiction writing, it was set in a post-apocalyptic world, a future where my Hebrew school in Queens had thankfully been blown to smithereens, a world I could really fall in love with. The protagonist of Zardoz is named Zed. He's an angry dork living in a world of savage, loincloth-wearing brutals. One day, curious Zed stows away inside a floating head and gets transported to the Vortex, a Santa Monica-like paradise on Earth, whose inhabitants are called Eternals and who never die. It is they who have created his god, Zardoz. The women of the Vortex look very much like Charlotte Rampling, and they treat Zed as their pet and science experiment, humiliating him turn by turn. 100 pages later, Zed learns to fight back, in the end destroying the Eternals' paradise and replacing it with a pockmarked ruined land not unlike New Jersey. The novel, steeped in the ethos of the early 70s, seems to think that this is a happy turn of events. He was a lone mammal adrift in their land, the novel says of Zed, which is essentially how I felt the first time I left Queens for the seductive complex land across the Queensboro Bridge. The Zed-like humiliations I suffered at the hands of Manhattan's young Charlotte Ramplings steeled me for what was required of me. Loss of innocence, the assumption of a strong, conceited personality, an endless array of pretensions. I was being groomed for Oberlin College and for the vortex beyond it. While I cannot quote you a single sentence of Jane Austen, I am embarrassed to confess that to this day, lines like, "Stay close to me, inside my aura," and "Harvest Produce Report, submit surpluses and needs for intervortex barter and exchange," fly right past my thick nerd lips.
Gary Steingart. His latest novel is called Super Sad True Love Story.
Researchers have found that people who sleep at least 8 hours are more likely to maintain a normal weight than those who sleep less. Now, a new study finds that even for infants and preschoolers, a long night's sleep may be just as important as diet and physical activity. NPR's Patty Naiman has this report on the study, which appears in the Archives of Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine.
Over the last 3 decades, obesity rates have doubled among children aged 2 to 5 and tripled among 6 to 11-year-olds. So Janice Bell wanted to know whether sleep had anything to do with it. Bell's a researcher at the University of Washington in Seattle. She looked at federal data collected on nearly 2,000 children and compared those who slept 10 hours or more a night to those who slept less. She also looked at how much the children weighed over a 5-year period. The most striking findings, says Bell, had to do with infants and toddlers.
They were nearly twice as likely to move from normal weight to overweight or from overweight to obese in that 5-year period.
Twice as likely to gain weight is a big difference, says Bell, and an important message to parents to help their children get on a routine schedule of a long and solid night's sleep, especially, she says, because napping during the day did not reduce the risk that these kids would gain weight.
We found that their napping didn't have any effect on their later obesity, whereas the nighttime sleep was significant. So that led us to conclude that napping didn't seem to be a substitute for nighttime sleep in terms of obesity prevention.
Bell's study didn't examine why it may be that children who sleep less gain weight, but she has some theories.
It may be that children who don't sleep enough at night are too tired to engage in the kind of physical activity that may prevent obesity. It could also be that there's a relationship between appetite hormones and later obesity. We know that that relationship between appetite hormones and sleep exists in adults.
And in adults, one sleep expert who's studied the relationship between sleep deprivation and appetite is Dr. Emmanuel Mignon, who directs the Center for Sleep Sciences and Medicine at Stanford University.
If you start to sleep less, there are certain hormones such as leptin or ghrelin that change in your blood in a way that stimulates your appetite.
And makes you crave unhealthy foods.
In fact, in one study, they compare snack food versus other type of foods, and they found that when you are sleep deprived, you seem to prefer snack food as opposed to healthy food.
And one reason naps may not work, says Mignon, is because daytime sleep is qualitatively different.
Sleep is better during the night. In fact, body temperature already drops, so that in fact the sleep that we have at night, even in adults, is always more restorative, deeper than if you try to sleep during the day.
On average, Mignon says, children up to age 5 need at least 10 hours of sleep a night. Infants and young toddlers, of course, need even more. Patty Naiman, NPR News.
In the small fishing village of Port Clyde, Maine, some determined fishermen have broken with tradition in an attempt to hold on to their way of life. They no longer try to catch as many fish as possible and sell them at auction. Instead, they've formed some unusual alliances. They want to learn how to fish more sustainably and market their fish directly to the public. Rachel Gutbaum reports.
In Port Clyde, almost everyone fishes or is related to someone who does. Dougie Anderson started fishing here with his grandfather when he was just 6 years old.
My goal all my young life was to be the youngest captain on the coast, and boats was everything to me.
Anderson says Port Clyde's waters used to be teeming with cod, flounder, and other groundfish. But by the 1970s, commercial fishing got easier.
And all of a sudden, we got a brand new fleet coming into New England. We had every piece of electronic equipment we needed. We had boats that we could fish more weather, and virtually a fish had no place it could hide.
Years of overfishing and increased fisheries regulation have taken a toll here, and most of Maine's commercial groundfish ports have gone out of business. Fishermen in Port Clyde managed to hang on until a few years ago when the government decreased the days they could fish, just as fuel prices skyrocketed. Glenn Libby has been fishing in Port Clyde for 40 years.
It got really tough. You weren't making much money, getting behind in your bills. It was easy to think about giving up.
So what did they do?
We got mad, I guess. Stopped blaming other people, tried to find solutions.
The fishermen in Port Clyde realized that they had to change the way they did business in order to survive. Instead of competing against one another, as they had done for generations, they formed a co-op. They began imitating the local farmers here, delivering batches of freshly caught seafood weekly to individual customers. Glenn Libby says it was a decidedly humble beginning.
We started out doing it with shrimp. We had about 30 people sign up to buy a 5-pound bag of shrimp every week.
To save money and get the best price for their fish, the Port Clyde Cooperative opened its own fish processing plant. In most cases, these fishermen can eliminate the middleman by filleting and packaging their catch and sending it out directly to farmers markets, health food stores, and restaurants. Port Clyde Fresh Catch, as it is now known, is becoming popular with chefs whose customers are demanding local and sustainable foods.
And then this is Mizuna's for the pork, and we need basil.
One of those chefs is Joseph Margate of the Liberty Hotel in Boston. He says he buys his fish directly from the Port Clyde fishermen whenever he can.
The whole idea of the menu is to put, you know, that your crab or your lobster or your halibut comes from Port Clyde. That's a better story.
So far, Port Clyde Fresh Catch is not making much of a profit, but business is growing. John Sacton is editor of Seafood News. He says what's happening in Port Clyde is becoming a model for small boat fishermen across the country.
The fishermen don't have the ability to make up their business by volume. So in order to keep fishing, they have to think about this in a different way. It does allow them to stay on the water and stay in the business.
The new business model for the Port Clyde fishermen is not just about how they sell their fish, but also how they catch it. They're now collaborating with the same environmental groups they once battled to learn how to fish in more sustainable ways. Back at Port Clyde Harbor, Glenn Libby's brother, Gary, is showing off his new environmentally sound fishing net.
This is a 7-inch square mesh cod end. It's larger than the legal size mesh. The reason for using this is to let the smaller fish get out, rebuild the fish stocks at a faster rate, so that we're not the last fishermen in Port Clyde.
The fishermen in Port Clyde say they're starting to see greater numbers of fish in the waters here again. But Glenn Libby says that even with the big changes they are making now, it could take generations to repair the fishery.
I've got a 15-year-old grandson, and all he wants to do is go fishing. And if we don't have a viable business, he's not going to be able to do it.
For centuries, fishermen everywhere have tried to make the best living possible by catching the most fish possible. But with fewer fish in the sea and greater restrictions on just what they can catch, the fishermen here in Port Clyde are learning that it's less about the number of fish they catch than marketing the very best fish. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Gotbaum.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time for All Tech Considered. Today, technologies for shedding pounds. In a moment, we'll go back in time to when chemicals produced in the laboratory started to compete with natural sweeteners in the name of weight loss. First, though, we are very much in the present tense with NPR's Anthony Brooks.
Want to lose weight? Well, it turns out there's an app for that. Charles Teague is the CEO of FitNow, a Boston-based startup company that's developed a weight loss program for the iPhone. It's called Lose It.
The concept is really, really simple. Get a budget, watch your calories, and you'll lose weight.
Lose It is free. You can download it to an iPhone, as Teague does, in about a minute. Then he enters his age, his weight, and his weight loss goal.
And then basically Lose It lays out a calorie budget. And so for me today, I can eat about 2,000 calories. And as I eat those calories, I just add them to my log. As I exercise, those calories actually get subtracted.
The process is relatively easy. A database counts the calories of thousands of foods, from an apple to a steak, potatoes, and pie. Throughout the day, you just enter whatever you eat or how much you've exercised, and the program tells you if you're staying within your caloric budget. BlackBerry and other smartphones have similar apps, and since Lose It was launched 18 months ago, more than 5 million people have downloaded it, making it one of the most popular apps on the iPhone.
My name is Wade Fallon. I'm 56 years old now. I live in Jacksonville, Florida.
Wade Fallon says he struggled for years with his weight, and then he tried the iPhone app.
So I started off at 275, and I stayed with this thing until March of this year. I had lost 65 pounds in roughly 6-7 months.
Fallon wants to lose a total of 100 pounds and get down to about 175.
I think it's very promising, and for some people, it's going to work very well.
Jason Block is a doctor at the Harvard Medical School who does obesity research. He says these mobile programs could make people more aware of what and how much they actually eat. But he says it's too soon to know if they're more effective than traditional weight loss programs. And he says they're not for everyone, especially those who don't want to be tethered to their smartphones all day. And while many users are reporting initial success with these programs, Block says keeping those pounds off is another matter.
You can't just lose weight and then go back to eating the same way that you did before. You have to make changes that you're going to be able to sustain.
And I learned that.
In fact, that proved to be a challenge for Wade Fallon, the man who lost 65 pounds. After his initial success, he stopped using the program.
Those few months that I stopped using it and I started eating the wrong things again, and I wound up putting that 65 pounds back on.
But Fallon says now he's counting calories again with his iPhone and has shed 15 pounds. That leaves 85 to go. Anthony Brooks, NPR News, Boston.